and the ghettos play. Long nights on a hot summer's block where you sip your brew and never touch your glass. This is for eyes that cry like yours and learn to smile again. Rise above the pain. This is for you and your crew, the ones that's true.
Spitfire comes together. Spitfire comes together to say no to the sounds in our voices. Spitfire, Women of Color Radio. Edition of Spitfire Radio of 2012. Spitfire Radio, Women of Color Radio, every last Wednesday of the month on CKUT 90.3 FM. This evening, Alyssa will report about the Idle No More movement, a nationwide grassroots movement to protest the Harper government's harsh policies and treatment of First Nations people. We will also be hearing from Mercedes about reality TV and its portrayal of black men. Spitfire also caught up with Debbie Young, dub poet and playwright, when she was in town for her show last month. And lastly, Alyssa will be speaking about Republican opposition to the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act, the main piece of federal legislation which addresses domestic violence and what it can mean for Native women. All this coming up next on Spitfire Radio, Women of Color Radio. When the mob came and got her and dragged her from the jail, madam, they strung her upon the old willow across the way. And the moment before she died, she lifted up her lovely head and cried, "Madam, Miss Otis regrets she's unable to lunch today."
Thousands of protesters across Canada, from Ottawa to Toronto to Winnipeg to Montreal, and even in England and Cairo, Egypt, gathered to protest the Harper government's hostile policies and treatment of First Nations people in a growing movement called Idle No More. Idle No More began with four women sharing a vision of bringing together all people to ensure that we create spaces of protecting Mother Earth, her lands, waters, and people. The women began discussing the possible impacts that some of the legislation proposed by the Harper government would carry if people do not do something. It became very evident that the women must do something about the colonial, unilateral, and paternalistic legislation being pushed through the Government of Canada's parliamentary system. The women began with a piece of legislation called Bill C-45, which attacked the land base reserved for Indigenous people. Today, I read from their press release. The women decided that they would call a rally to inform the public that this bill intended to, without consent, give the Minister of Indian Affairs power to surrender the lands reserved. They felt that this would ultimately make room for oil, nuclear, and gas industries to tear up the land for profit. From this rally, they also informed the public on other legislation that affected and ignored the treaties made with the Crown, but also the waters, land, and people that would impact it in very harmful ways. The women then held other communities to coordinate efforts to hold similar rallies with the same goal in mind: stand up and speak out against undemocratic and internationally illegal government acts. These rallies took place all across the country. The women see that there were many other communities that needed to come together and act in solidarity and resurgence to assert their inherent rights as a sovereign nation. Thus, the National Day of Solidarity and Resurgence was called for December 10, 2012. This was an enormous event that never in history had been seen, where so many nations and diverse groups of people came together. These events and acts have continued to grow, and from the talk of grassroots, has no intention of slowing down. The group called Idle No More has witnessed these events spreading out internationally, within the United States as well as the United Kingdom, sharing and helping to support the cause of opposing the government's actions as well as to support asserting nationhood. The mission of Idle No More. Idle No More calls on all people to join in a revolution which honors and fulfills Indigenous sovereignty, which protects the land and water. Colonization continues through attacks to Indigenous rights and damage to the land and water. We must repair these violations, live the spirit and intent of the treaty relationship, work towards justice in action, and protect Mother Earth. On December 10th, Indigenous people and allies stood in solidarity across Canada to assert Indigenous sovereignty and begin the work towards sustainable, renewable development. All people will be affected by the continued damage to the land and water, and we welcome Indigenous and non-Indigenous allies to join in creating healthy, sustainable communities. We encourage youth to become engaged in this movement, as you are the leaders of our future. There have always been individuals and groups who have been working toward these goals. Idle No More seeks to create solidarity and further support these goals. We recognize that there may be backlash and encourage people to stay strong and united in spirit. Idle No More contends that the treaties are nation-to-nation agreements between Canada and First Nations people, who are sovereign nations. The treaties are agreements that cannot be altered or broken by one side of the two nations. The spirit and intent of the treaty agreements meant that First Nations peoples would share the land, but retain their inherent rights to lands and lands resources. Instead, First Nations people have experienced a history of colonization, which has resulted in outstanding land claims, lack of resources, and unequal funding for services such as education and housing. Idle No More contends that Canada has become one of the wealthiest countries in the world by using the land and resources. Canadian mining, logging, oil, and fishing companies are the most powerful in the world due to the land and resources. Some of the poorest First Nations communities have mines or other developments on their land, but do not get a share of the profit. The taking of resources has left many lands and waters poisoned. The animals and plants are dying in many areas in Canada. We cannot live without the land and water. We have laws older than this colonial government about how to live with the land. Idle No More contends that currently, the government is trying to pass many laws so that reserve lands can also be bought and sold by big companies to get profit from resources. They are promising to share this time. Why would these promises be different from past promises? We will be left with nothing but poisoned water, land, and air. This is an attempt to take away sovereignty and inherent rights to land and resources from First Nations people. Idle No More believes that we believe in a healthy, just, equitable, and sustainable communities and have a vision and plan of how to build them. Idle No More urges all of us to share in creating this vision. Idle No More calls on people to continue to oppose and reject all imposed legislation originating from the Harper government. The unilateral imposition of these bills is in direct violation of the treaties and the treaty relationship that the original peoples of Turtle Island made with the British Crown. Indigenous peoples and nations have not been consulted, and therefore the actions taken by the federal government do not reflect the international standard of free, prior, and informed consent. The continued imposition of federal legislation on Indigenous peoples and governments is not in line with the legal principles of acting in good faith and maintaining the honor of the Crown. There are many nations taking actions to reflect acts of Indigenous nationhood, sovereignty, and jurisdiction in response to the passing of legislation such as Bill C-45, and we must continue on this path. When we stand strong and believe in our ways and assert acts of nationhood, it does not matter what amount of legislation the federal government introduces or passes, because it is not with our consent and therefore is not applicable. Idle No More urges all the supporters to stand strong and believe in the spirit and intent of Native Peoples' treaties, as that is what their ancestors are calling us to do. To get involved or to follow the Idle No More movement, you can go to their blog at idlenomore1.blogspot.ca.
Hello. This is Amina Claudine Maris. Whenever I'm in Montreal, I like to listen to CKUT 90.3 FM.
This is Spitfire Women of Color Radio. It's 6:15 p.m. and a negative 10 degrees out. You're about to hear Mercedes with a piece on the depiction of black men in reality television.
We all cannot deny our fascination with reality television shows, even if we do not personally watch them. The intrinsic pull of human curiosity to the latest media spectacle cannot be helped, considering one is bound to hear about it through word of mouth or via one's respective media source. I, for one, can say that I have been a victim of such curiosity, and later find myself thinking, I can't wait to tune in next week. The sheer guilty pleasure we receive from having watched the latest episode is added ammunition to continue watching until the end of the season or until the next big escapade comes rolling around the corner. It seems that reality television has become a media phenomenon that has become part of our social existence in terms of how we interact with one another, but more importantly, how we perceive other people. One such perception that I would like to call attention to is the way in which people of lower socioeconomic standing are depicted in reality crime shows like The First 48 or Cops, but more specifically the ways in which the black man is perceived in these shows. Now, I know that this isn't a new concern, but even if most of these shows are American-based, I am just about tired of watching them and knowing that more often than not, the suspect or person of interest is a young black man. It's to the point where I can watch the program and not even need to follow the quote-unquote storyline to arrive at this conclusion. But this changes when the theme of the show is concerning preventative crime measures, such as through sting operations. Granted, there are exceptions like Datelines to Catch a Predator, where I do not question the methods used, but for these kind of shows, where I find myself questioning the moral and ethical motives of the operation, I'm dumbfounded that something like this is permissible to happen and appealing to viewers as a form of entertainment. One such show is Bait Car, aired on the Action Television Network on Sundays at 5 p.m., which documents a police operation in which cars are parked purposely with their keys left in the ignition in various neighborhoods in the States. Mind you that they are not neighborhoods that look like Westmount or off-island suburbs, and these cars are left there to see who will attempt to steal them. Once the perpetrator is in the car and has started driving off with the stolen car, this is when the police officers spring into action to stop the auto theft in progress and subsequently arrest the thief on the spot. To many, it may be entertaining to watch the perpetrator attempt to escape not only the car, but also arrest, but I worry that the seriousness of what is unfolding is never addressed in the minds of the viewers. Yes, one can say it is an attempt to stop or lower the rates of auto theft in certain areas, but at whose expense? When I look at an episode and see that there is more than one occasion where a black man gets into one of these cars, and the camera in the bait car is depicting him as proud or being able to capitalize on someone's mistake, so the leaving of the keys in the ignition, and he's later made out to be a fool because he is then arrested, what does this say about his character? What does this show to the viewers about this man? This kind of situation does nothing to destigmatize already damaging images of how black men are portrayed in society and the media, and only adds to the already degrading experience of racial profiling by police. I feel it is reality shows like Bait Car that blur the lines between entertainment and thinking critically we are viewing, and it is time to rebuild this distinction.
This is Michelle Ndegeocello, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Keep it locked.
Fire escapes in case of heartbreak, disappeared to Montreal in the southern fall season. Something to believe in, heaven saw that reason. That was time to bear it all for your dreams. Cut the keys then, bangs, tease. Winter's cool breeze, free as a bird. With nothing but time, I'm safe keeping. Found my way seeking, dark and days are leaving. Rain boots dancing, muddy clay kept daydreaming. He said, I heard you leaving. I said, yeah, not eating right in the big city for years. No longer pretty that way for heat. Take turn, my time to speak. Burn sometimes, I wind through streets, unkind memories. Grind to eat, make two new beginnings. No time to sleep, awake takes two forgiving. Taking time to read, heartbreaking work, a staggering genius. But again, I'll always mean it when I tell you that I like to. From the day that we met, I bet you think I say the things I forget. And try my best this time, cross my heart and hope for signs. Rope it's open down, soak the grime out, rug to dry. Just to get by, bumping quality out of speakers, timber. Peace to all the spirits gone, well, they sometimes linger. Rain season, apologies, reason, post-data, can't remember, yeah, I've been until November, shit.
Hanging out all of Montreal in the fall, now we're free to be chasing it all, so long to yesterday, sipping wine in the middle of day, life is so much better this way, so long, he said, hanging out Montreal in the fall.
Breeze, the changing times, the changing leaves. I'm a baby to me, the plots are ripening. Just the peach, the seed grows juicy and deep. Summer, how you leave me soft in slumber. Turn my back, you were gone. Paper stacks, not forgotten for this love thing. Look above, but night still closing in. Where does it end, where to begin? Montreal daylight fights within. Wine and cheese in the day, Port Royal in the bay. Belle Provence, où commencer ça?
des peines comme vous ne pensez pas. Spotlight and fancy cars, LA bigger stars, preteen push-up bras, that life ain't for me. Sharp in life, but quite a journey. Spark in flight, a riot churning, one fire burning. No lie of a word, my story hurt, these years they turn.
You're listening to Spitfire Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM every last Wednesday of the month at 6 p.m. This is our last edition of 2012. You're listening to Major One, Montreal in the Fall, and up next we'll be hearing from dub poet and playwright Vivian.
Debbie Young is a Jamaican womanist, warrior artist, internationally celebrated for her unapologetic, explosive consciousness on the mic. A second-generation dub poet whose mother, Anita Stewart, is one of the pioneers of the genre. Debbie's lyricism emerges from the roots of dub, entwined with the rhythms of dancehall, reggae, hip-hop, punk rock, and dubstep. Her performance art is a banyan tree of theatricality, with branches extending across cultural boundaries and social norms, springing into revolution. She has headlined festivals in Cuba, South Africa, Swaziland, Spain, Jamaica, Canada, the UK, America, and France. Debbie is the published author of 2 collections of poetry, 4 plays, 6 albums, and is the originator of the Biomyths or Plusi methodology. Her latest CD, 333, is a love letter to all dancehall queens, queers, and questioners of the status quo. Earlier this month, Debbie was in Montreal as part of her 333 global tour. We caught up with her and asked her about her inspirations, her preparations, how she navigates the art world, and all while staying healthy.
Such a pleasure and an honor to be here at the 2110 Center for Gender Advocacy interviewing the legendary poet Debbie Young. Debbie, how are you doing today?
I'm legendary. Dun, 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 dun. I'm doing well. Having a beautiful, beautiful day. I'm in a wonderful mood coming out of last night's performance.
And by legendary, I don't mean old. I just mean legendary. just clarifying that. Debbie, I have so much I want to talk to you about. I guess I first want to start by asking you to just take us back to the beginning. Where did it start for you? It can be whatever you want it to be. Why did this life take you to this place? Why did you become the artist that you are now? And where do you think the journey that you embarked upon began in the way that it did?
I feel like when I think of that question, I can answer it on so many levels. I'm just beginning to learn about quantum physics and the fact that all the atoms in our bodies are recycled from, you know, all the atoms that have ever existed, which have also been in the bodies of all the most wonderful revolutionaries and philosophers and mystics and witches and warlocks and magicians. So where did it begin? I don't know. But if I think about the legacy of my mother, then it began with my mother, you know, who had me at 15 and who became a dub poet herself and one of the pioneer dub poets. And you can imagine her having me that early. It was like growing up with my sister for a lot of it. So we lived with my grandmother and my mom's other aunts who also had children. So I grew up with a whole bunch of cousins, even though I was an only child. And we grew up in a working class neighborhood, Shortwood Lane, for like the first 7 years of my life. Then we moved to Maxfield Avenue, which is like another working class neighborhood, just neighboring Trenchtown. So I grew up among people who had to work for a living, you know, people who had children, families that were living in close community, both blood-related community and non-blood-related community, and also a neighborhood that was rife with violence. So all of that mixed together creates this really dramatic reality, you know? And so I had drama in that sense, and then I had drama through poetry and drama through theater, drama through the pantomime of Jamaica, and all kinds of art and dance and music was all around. So children who grew up in Jamaica are artists, even if they don't are not professionals at it. Then, as I grew older, I thought that dub poetry particularly was attractive because it was talking about the poor people. And I was poor. So it was talking about me. And at home, we were having all kinds of, like, contradictions around the importance of the girl child and the girl child's role in the family and the woman's role in the family. And you can imagine, like every other young person, I was trying to find myself, you know, not seeing myself necessarily reflected and validated at home all the time, sometimes, but not all the time. I turned to dub because my mother was doing dub and she had all this like eyes on her and validation from doing dub, you know? So dub always made sense because I could always see myself in it and it always had room for me to speak. That, I feel, sets the foundation, you know? As I grew older and continued to like navigate myself, my role in a Canadian society, I moved here when I was 15, I drifted away from Jamaica and dub and all that that part of my life represented because it there's so much pain that came with it as well. And Canada presented this like way of escape, escape by total assimilation. And so for the first 4 years, I experimented with that. Like, what would it be to completely immerse yourself, particularly linguistically, in a culture, you know? So I developed this interesting accent. And I remember living in Montreal, having left Toronto, moved to Montreal to go to McGill, having a conversation with a dear friend and mentor of mine, Dave Austin, who was like, why do you have that accent? I tell this story repeatedly because in my mind, it signifies a pivotal moment in my life at around 1920, where I was really asked the question, embedded, was who are you? How are you? And what is your purpose? And those three questions are the three questions that I live by now, you know? Dub, art making, art activism, art education, for me, is my way of affecting revolution. You know, and I think my entire life I've been moving through different stages of realizing that. You know, it makes the most sense to me. That's why I do it.
For somebody who has never heard of your work, has never seen you perform, has never explored or been able to explore the themes and the intensity that your work is, how would you describe it to them?
It feels to me in my own body that I'm sitting by a tree with my grandmother who is telling me a story. And I remember some of those moments, I would really get to experience and inner experience the movement and the emotions of these characters. If she was telling me about Anansi, the spider, I could see myself either somewhere in the jungle watching Anansi or embodying Anansi and moving through all the things that he was doing. So it feels to me like that is what I am able to share with people, is what my grandmother was able to share with me, which is like using your entire body, using your eyes, using your language, using your, this invisible energy that is being reciprocated between the storyteller and the village, using all of that so that each member of the village who's witnessing the story gets to go on a personal journey where they then, somewhere in the act of listening, they then begin to reflect on themselves. So they're watching the performer, but it's not just about watching the performer. It's also about, who am I? What has happened to me? What have I done with those things? What do I do to people? What do I want to do? What is my potential for fullness and wholeness? And it's crucial for me that while people are experiencing the story, that they experience themselves, not just experience me. And I think that that's what I do. I help people to experience themselves through the work that I do. You know, it's really quite accessible and simple. Because I think also too, as storytellers, we have to make our processes accessible to people so that doesn't seem like some kind of highfalutin, convoluted mess of a inaccessible reality that's up on a pedestal. It's like old school storytelling. That's what it is. And I think it comes off the way it does for people because it's something that we're doing less and less. You know, so when you experience something as a rarity, you know, you then begin to appreciate it. But the fact that something's popular doesn't mean that it has to be non-sacred. Do you know what I'm saying? So storytelling can be a popular people's art, like it has always been, and still be sacred. And I think when people experience the energy within the space that we co-create, they also experience the sacred, which makes it feel so magical. But the sacred is within all of us. Like, and unless it was within all of us, we couldn't create that space together in, like, let's say, like last night at La Sala Rosa. That's because each person is adding an energy of sacredness to the environment. So then it really does fill the room, and it helps me to tell the story, but it also helps the audience to experience the story as well, you know? But it's old school. Who amongst us carries the sage secrets of loving? Where are our elders, our children? The ones who walk with the old-time knowledge of a healing love, an unapologetic love, an uncompromising love, an honest love.
This might lead well into my next question, which is, I think I've attended maybe 7 or 8 of your performances, each one just as intense as the one before. And I don't mean intense in an amorphous way. I mean, I just don't know how else to describe it. But I'm always struck by the pointed reactions and the way the reactions move, either from absolute silence and concentration, could hear a pin drop, to chance, to ambiguity, and each one moves, and it's fluid. It comes back to silence. It comes back to cheering. Sometimes people check out because it's just too intense, and it takes them to a place that they're not able to go to right now. And I guess my question is, as a performer, how does that affect your art, how you perceive your art, and are you concerned with the way people react if people are able to attend to what you are through your storytelling presenting them?
I think the first thing that's crucial for me to acknowledge is the fact that people come into the room already, for me, is such a huge honor to witness. The fact that the person, the individual, chooses is a very big deal. I try to take the stage seriously and sacredly, and it's important for me that each audience member feels that. So we're mutually accountable and responsible for each other. There's a lot of accountability and responsibility within the joy But it's crucial for you to know that I'm going to do my very best to make the storytelling session as interesting and engaging and challenging and intriguing and magical as I possibly can. Like those, I think about those things. They don't just happen accidentally. They happen magically in the sense that I cannot control or manipulate them. That the best thing that I can do is to meditate before a show so that the energy can flow, because I can't control it. I can't, you know, when I start to get involved in those things, like being a younger performer earlier in my career, trying to figure out how to negotiate the energy that comes off the audience and comes off me, and like thinking it's about control or I want to make it this way. Now it's like the process of meditating, I think, for the storyteller, of preparing yourself, allows then for the emergence of an organic, magical energy that you cannot know is going to happen before the show. I can never know how it's going to go. But what I have noticed is that the more I prepare, the more I meditate, the more that I look at my own self-knowledge, my own orality, my own rhythm, political content, context. These are principles that I use. Language of communication, the urgency, the sacredness, and the integrity in my work. And I use those principles every day. They impact me. I question them. I name them, you know. The more that I do that and actually take the time in the day or days before, weeks before, months before, to prepare for the storytelling session, 100% the show goes phenomenally. Because the storyteller is a conduit, and everybody in the room is like conducting energy, but the storyteller, given the nature of storytelling, one person is speaking, many people are listening, even if they're responding, given the nature of that, the storyteller is a conduit for the energy that's moving in the room, you know, to be able to conduct that energy along with the rest of the members of the room. It's like, it's an involved process, you know, it's a very involved process. And the older I get, the more I realize how involved it is and simple it is, that all I have to do is get out the way. Like, all I have to do is be clear in my own body, and the show, with my intention, with my clear intention of loving the audience or loving myself or bringing a message of love, that unfolds in the show. And I'm just learning that the older I get.
There is fiction in the space between the lines on your page of memories. Write it down, but it doesn't mean not just telling stories.
You're listening to Spitfire Women of Color Radio on CKUT. We are talking to Debbie Young. Debbie, I wanted to switch gears a bit and ask you about how you navigate the politics of the art world in Canada and internationally. Your struggle for support, for resources, for politically like minds, for people who are not trying to exploit you, and how you feel that the Canadian community is conducive to that, is challenging you, is an impediment to progress, how you see things have changed since you began, perhaps, politics of the art world.
It's such a beautiful question, because it's at once very complicated and very simple, like everything else. My very simplest approach is I pay as little attention as I possibly can to energy that is going to interrupt my flow. That is seriously one of my strategies. I just try to give it less and less and less of my time. And rather, what I do is I create spaces for myself by writing my own music, by writing my own poetry, by producing shows, you know, by performing in the community, in the high school, in the community center, by valuing the people who are everyday people, by valuing them, so that those spaces, those performances like last night, those for me are the crucial ones. You know, talking to a group of grade fives is crucial. You know, going to a jail is crucial. So I've developed through community, through mentorship, through being raised by a village, a lens that reminds me constantly to value the people on the ground. Now, when you're playing by your own rules, i.e. I don't audition for shows, I don't advertise for anybody, I don't have a manager, I'm not in a corporate system of storytelling, I just refuse. When you're outside of those boundaries, there's a lot that you can do. There's a lot that you can do. In fact, it's limitless, you know? So whatever other trappings like storytellers have around, like the wage slavery, you know, and around, you know, because they're involved in like a corporate system, they've got to do certain things, you know, I'm just not in that space, you know? So my considerations are more about how do I self-actualize? Like, what do I really want to do? How do I want to do it? And those are the same conversations I have with the people around me. You know, it's like, so how do you want to liberate yourself? What does that look like for you? You know, so navigating the art world, that system, you know, in so many ways, I'm outside of it. I get granted and funded, but I'll tell you, like, being granted and funded, I think, has come also from not playing that game, that granting game, which is, you know, you make your grant like this, so you get it like that, and then you leave out this part of yourself, so you get it like that. I just don't even do that. I just write what I intend, and if I get it, I get it, and if I don't, well, I'm still gonna do the project. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, I think it's crucial to see ourselves outside of the manipulation of systems, like to envision ourselves outside of that. Then we can actually begin to live outside of that.
I guess then my question would be, how is that sustainable for you? How have you been able to kind of continue a community, and a community that sustains, that can have resources outside of a system? One thing I have to say is that it's so refreshing, as somebody who knows so many women of color in Canada with health problems as a result of just living in this horrible system. It's so nice to see how healthy you look, and how in every way it just looks healthy. And it's so nice to see. So, and not just because, like, you're in shape. Like, I just, healthy in every way, like mind, body, soul. So if, can you please kind of talk about that for people who are listening, who are interested in sustaining our creative self without being limited by these structures?
We have no other choice. I think we have to begin to understand that there is no other choice but to take care of ourselves and see the politics of self-care as crucial. In fact, the foundation of any other politics, race politics, gender politics, sexuality politics, activism in any shape or form. If we cannot care for ourselves, then whatever space we're working in is like deeply flawed and like really set up for failure. I think self-care is the first revolution. Then with self-care comes self-knowledge, right? With self-care comes, who am I? How am I? What is my purpose? With self-care comes, if I want to end abusive cycles in the society, then I've got to end abusive cycles within myself. Self-care, it's the first actual point of interaction. Now, if we go beyond self-care, around self-care, under self-care, above self-care, to do some other stuff, then we're running. We're not actually doing anything. Like, we're hamsters in a wheel, you know? So a holistic approach in anything that we do, whether we're an accountant or a yoga teacher, is our looking at our emotional selves, our physical selves, our mental, intellectual, philosophical selves, our creative selves, and our spiritual selves. Like we've got to look at those things, and each of those bodies represents such a big part of who we are in terms of how we identify. For me, I have to go through that before I get to anything else. Like, I can't talk to you about love while I'm not eating properly. Like, I can't talk to you about revolution while I'm not willing to look at, like, my own bigotry. You know, I can't talk to you about consistency while I'm unwilling to look at the fact that I am inconsistent, whether it's by choice or not. I think we've got to go through ourselves in order to get to the external. And if we don't do that, then we're circumventing the issue around, and you know what I'm saying? So I have to take care of myself. Otherwise, I'm like a hypocrite.
Such a great answer. We're going to be wrapping up. I guess I just want to finish by asking you your biggest challenge and your best lesson.
I think the biggest challenge for me is to constantly speak what I interpret as the truth. It's so crucial that what I say for myself, that I'm actually practicing and living it, because that for me is integrity. And when I feel the most disintegritous, it's those moments where I'm saying one thing but I'm practicing differently, and that's such a, for me, that's such a representation of the entire globe. You know, you're like, you're from a certain faith that says, like, treat your neighbor properly, but then you sanction war by sending children to die. You know, you believe that things should be liberated, but then, you know, animals are dying to be a certain material, and you really like the material, you know, but you don't sanction the killing of animals or the use of their bodies, you know, as clothes. So these contradictions, these, I think it's really crucial to tell the truth, you know. I think that that's important. That's the biggest challenge. And then the other one was the best lesson. I think the best lesson for me is understanding at its core that revolution means love. So whatever perspective we're taking this idea of revolution from, doesn't matter. At the end of the day, it has to come back down to love.
Revolution means love. And on that note, we thank you so much, Debbie Young.
Weapons of mass. System. We need to change ourselves. We have got to make this world user-friendly. User-friendly. Are you ready to sacrifice to end world hunger? To sacrifice to end colonialism? To end neocolonialism? Exploitation. Revolution means respecting people from other cultures. Revolution is creative. Revolution means treating your mate as a friend and an equal. Revolution is sexy. Revolution means respecting and learning. Is beautiful. Revolution means protecting the people.
love. This is Mary J. Blige, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
CKUT on the air, live for CKUT.
You're listening to Spitfire Women of Color Radio every last Wednesday of the month at 6 p.m. Up next, we have Alyssa, who will be discussing the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act.
To put it crudely, Republican lawmakers in the United States Congress are coming to the aid of perpetrators who target Native American women, queer women, and immigrant women. In the latest evidence that the Republican Party is an all-white male party, Republicans in the U.S. Congress are putting up a fight against the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act, first passed in 1994 and twice reauthorized since. Though criticized for its buying into the tough-on-crime conservative mantra, the act remains the main piece of federal legislation that attempts to address domestic violence. VAWA, as it's called, allocates taxpayer money to programs and services helping those suffering from abuse, including community violence prevention programs, funding for rape crisis centers and hotlines, and legal aid for survivors of violence. Funds are also used to help investigate and prosecute violent crimes against women. If not reauthorized by the end of this year, VAWA will not be renewed, and funding to these causes will cease, pending a stopgap measure until the new Congress convenes in January. Congress voted to reauthorize VAWA in 2000 and again in 2005, but the House stalled the act this spring when Republicans took issue with the Senate's expansions passed earlier in April. The revised version passed by the Senate extended provisions for protection to LGBT people, immigrants, and Native Americans to receive protection. The House rejected the Senate's version and countered with its own act excluding those groups. The House Judiciary Committee passed the Cantor-Adams alternative version of the bill that would not give major tribal courts jurisdiction to prosecute non-Native American abusers and offenders, taking away legal protections for many abused Native American women. Native American women experience the highest rate of sexual assault in the United States, at more than twice the national average. According to Amnesty International, 86% of Native American women who are raped are attacked by non-Indians on reservations. These perpetrators are not within the jurisdiction of tribal authorities. Tribal authority to prosecute non-Indians for crimes against tribal citizens was removed by the Supreme Court in 1978, creating an Indian country landscape for serial rapists on reservations, non-Native men who know they are outside the law. This is particularly damning given that, unlike other women of other races who are more likely to be attacked by a member of their race, Native American women are more likely to be attacked or assaulted by a male perpetrator not part of their race, typically a white male. The long-standing jurisdictional loophole creates a human rights crisis where some of the most heinous crimes go unpunished solely because the victim is Native and was assaulted on an Indian reservation. Thus, the revised anti-domestic legislation was drafted with these concerns in mind and was carefully written after months of collaboration with law enforcement, advocacy groups, judges, prosecutors, and health professionals. Recently, House Republicans proposed a compromise to assuage fear of lack of due process for non-Native perpetrators by allowing tribal courts to try non-Indians while still letting defendants move the case to a federal court if they felt their rights were not being protected. but the House Whip, Eric Cantor, appears, for the moment, to be steadfast in refusing to protect all women against domestic violence, because not allowing tribal authority jurisdiction over non-Native Americans is a more important Republican priority. The domestic violence protections in the Senate version of the bill were the result of over a decade of tireless activism and courage by Native American women all over the United States, demanding equal protection. Given the wide time lapse between the legislation's renewal, this political moment is crucial for getting these protections into law. We commend the efforts of Native women in the United States and deplore the conduct of an increasingly repugnant Republican Party, resolute in defending the rights of perpetrators of marginalized women.
Spitfire breathes the lives of women of color in Montreal.
We had to speak our truths and to say no to the silencing of our voices
rage,
in a racist and sexist
joy,
society.
Spoken word. Interview.
What's that?
Hot.
Spitfire breathes the lives of women of color in Montreal.
Tune in to Spitfire every last Wednesday of the month from 6 to 7 p.m. on 90.3 FM CKUT Radio.
Turn it up.
Are we on the air?
Uh-huh.
You in the air?
All over the world, man. Gotta make that money, man. Make your money, y'all. Just do what you got to do.
That brings us to the end of our show. Spitfire Women of Color Radio broadcasts every last Wednesday of the month at 6 p.m. on CKUT Radio 90.3 FM. You can always email us at spitfire@ckut.ca. That's S-P-I-T-F-I-Y-A-H at ckut.ca. Or check out our blog at www.spitfireblog.blogspot.ca, where you can listen to our past shows. So thanks for tuning in this month, and see you in 2013.
Don't wanna be your slave, and I'm not gonna take it how you wanna. Love me or hate me, support me or snake me. Either way, I show love. Let it make me or break me. I'm the queen of self-esteem. Don't sweat the cream, just set the scene. Get to cream like how you mean. Straight up, one of the best that's been. Ain't no puppet on a string. Like them hoes sucking on your thing. Overworked and underpaid for days. Behave, I'm not gonna be your slave.